My guest today, who I spoke with a month ago, is Dr. Munzer Sliman. He's the director of Think Tank's Monitor, founder of the Center for Arab and American Arab Studies, as a founding member of the National Council of Arab Americans, and vice chair of its National Board for Political Affairs. He's an independent media consultant with more than 25 years of experience in Middle East diplomacy and media relations, and a frequent commentator and guest analyst on radio and TV broadcasts. I spoke with him on February 9th, 2 days before Egypt's President Mubarak resigned. And much has happened in Egypt and across North Africa and the Middle East since then, and certainly more than can be covered in a single program, but we'll give it a try. Welcome, Munzer Sliman, once again to Takes on the World.
Yes, thank you very much.
Yes. It has been exactly a month since we spoke about the uprising in Egypt, and that extraordinary time we have seen a dictator, Mubarak, fall, and protests continuing to spread in North Africa and what we call the Middle East, demanding the resignation of dictators, kings, and presidents for life. While hundreds have been killed by the government forces, these protests have been largely nonviolent until they moved to Libya, where if the hawks in Washington have their way, another war is looming. But let's begin with Egypt. How do you assess the developments there since Mubarak's resignation?
There was, at times, slow movement to achieve the goals set by the uprisers. But with the persistence and continued demonstration and vigilance, they were able to push the military council to acquiesce to some key demands. So I think, in particular, the issue of appointing a new prime minister and getting rid of the cabinet that appointed by Mubarak. And also to eliminate some of the figures from the cabinet that they were aligned with the regime and they were serving the regime. So I think this is a good sign. The other sign was some of the arrangement with a committee to look at the current constitution and try to change some feature in the constitution and articles that was serving Mubarak, and calling for a referendum on those on March 19th. So to larger extent, I think the uprising in Egypt is moving slowly toward achieving the goals, but of course, no revolution is going to be completely clean from any kind of interference, kind of movement by the former regime that has been in place for a longer time to try to put obstacles. But I think the main issue here that the army and the military council, despite being, in my opinion, a reserve power for the past regime, and despite being serving as the sole legitimate power or kind of source of legitimacy, what we are witnessing is, especially from the speech of the Prime Minister at the Midan Tahrir, at the Square Tahrir last Friday, when he said, you appointed me, my legitimacy comes from you, and if there is any problem, I will come back to you. That's the main issue now is in the eyes of most people in Egypt and throughout the world, that the legitimacy, the source of legitimacy is the people, and that's a good development.
Now, there are people, particularly on the outside, who said, well, look, the army has now taken over. Was there any alternative at that point to the army stepping in for an interim period?
I think if we look at what happened in Libya, the possibility of having a conflict, that a violent conflict, and could be possible if the military was put in a position, whether by the regime who was pressuring. First of all, the regime put the military in place to quell the uprisings, not to play a mediator or to play a peaceful role here. But they resisted after what they saw, because it's really overwhelming to see the sea of people that demonstrating against the regime. So I think this military is still of the past, military of the past regime, and whatever it's doing, it's not doing voluntarily. They're doing it at the pressure of the movement, the revolutionary movement in Egypt. So there was at times some minor clashes occurred, especially at the time when they wanted to clear the square. There was time when they really allow the thugs to come into the Tahrir Square, if you recall. And they were also, that was a tense time. So I think it's a delicate situation for the military, in the military role. I think if they continue to play kind of a supervising role for allowing the new government to take hold and for really having interim period that allowing for election and constitutional assembly to bring a new constitution and to elect a new president, because I think the design was at one time is to extend the rule of Mubarak without Mubarak for another 6 years or at least 4 years. Now the new constitution amendment allow for only the president to serve for 4 years term and for a maximum of 2 terms. So it was originally was for 6 years, and he can get as much as he wants, like Mubarak was for life. So or he was going to appoint his son Jamal. So I think it is a good development that the military is being put in a position where they continue to supervise, continue to play an interim role. But that is not going to be for a longer period than 6 months. And the new cabinet, the new prime minister, is representative of the people, because he was former minister of transportation, but he came to the square of Tahrir and he demonstrated with the people. So it was really for them a vindication when he was appointed after such a struggle to get rid of that awful government that appointed by Mubarak.
No, I read yesterday, I mentioned to my listeners before I called you that he was carried from Tahrir Square on the shoulders of the former protesters, as reported in the Daily Star of Beirut yesterday. When will these constitutional amendments be made public, or have they been made public?
Yeah, they have been made public, and they are going to be, because the committee was given 10 days to bring them, and they already been public and published, and the referendum going to be on those amendments on the 19th of this month.
Now, I also understand that after that, according to the article, the nominations or the campaign for who's going to be the president of Egypt will then begin, and Mohamed al-Baradei, who is actually very close to the new prime minister, Hassan Sharaf, will be running for president. What are his chances?
I don't think Baradei would be the only person that potentially running. There are many people are getting ready for this, since the amendment will allow for many people. You don't need to have the restrictions that were in place before, because they eliminated many of the articles that were put in place to eliminate any potential competitor for Mubarak or his son. So now the field is open. I don't think Baradei would be the favorite, by the way. I think there is many people. It's hard to speculate. Even Amr Moussa, the current Secretary General of the Arab League, is...
He's planning on running, yes.
Yeah, planning to run. But there is many others. They are talking about running, and some well-known, some not so well-known. And I think between now and the time of the election, we're going to have a better picture about the alignment between the people, the political party that are forming now. There's current political party are reorganizing themselves. So I don't think Baradei is going to be the front runner, or is he is now the front runner. Although at one time, prior to the collapse of the regime, there was some momentum for him because people they want anything but Mubarak. But now, after the regime collapse, the people are thinking seriously about having a figure that well connected with the needs of the people. I think Baradei, despite some qualification, but he'll spend most of his time outside the country. He's not really connected with the struggle of the people. And I think the revolution in Egypt is going to produce probably some other figure, although not probably 100%. But I don't think figures that had some question about their connection to the outside, because this revolution, at the essence of this revolution, there was a slogan about human dignity. Human dignity, it translated in the Arab world, it's also a national dignity, which means that we don't want a regime to serve the master, whether in Washington or in any other place, whether in Tel Aviv or in Washington. So I think there is a deep desire to change the course and the direction of the country, and that direction would be to put in place a president and a government that will not be playing a role of serving United States policies or interests or any outside interest, but the Egyptian people interest.
My guest is Munzer Suleiman. We are speaking to him on KZOX. This is Takes on the World. My name is Jeff Blankford. Speaking of Washington, both President Obama and Secretary Clinton have expressed their desires of what they would like to see happen in Egypt. Incredible audacity to even use those terms, but we want to see, as they say. And they're particularly concerned because everything in Washington being filtered through the eyes of the what is good, quote, good for Israel, are concerned about the role of the Muslim Brotherhood. What role have they played or appear to be playing at the moment?
Well, during the uprising, some of their leadership, they were reluctant to join, but some of their youth, they already were part of the movement, and subsequently, they joined, all of them, and despite their presence, and they are well organized and not official opposition like some other official opposition at that time, they are part of the movement, but they have presence, influence inside the movement, but they don't have the upper hand. It seems. And that's one reason why some of the leadership in the movement, they ask for extended period of time to prepare for the election so they could form their own political parties and they could organize themselves. So they are, even if we want to talk about last election in 2005, a parliamentary election, they represented about 20%. So I think with the kind of uprising we have, I don't think even that probably 20% is currently correct. I mean, they probably less than that. So I think they realize that they want to be a legitimate party, but according even to the new constitution, they have to form probably a different political party, a different name, because you cannot have a party based on religious affiliation exclusively. You have to have some sort like a la mode of Turkey or others to have a general name for the party, although it could have and contain Islamic aspiration and guidance or whatever. But so I think their place now is part of what's been forming as a new movement, but they are not, they don't have the upper hand in deciding the direction of the revolution in Egypt, or they will be participating in any election, talking about the parliamentary election or Majlis Shura, which is consultative body. It's like, you know, upper chamber and lower chamber here in the United States, or Senate or Congress representatives. So I think they decided, or they announced, that they will not be having their own candidate for the presidency. So it seems that situation is getting smoother with other parts, despite what an occurrence that occurred between the Copt and the Muslim in one of the small town lately, that it seems to me that it's going to be under control, because during the revolution days, nobody remembered anything happened between, you know, like religious conflict among the Muslims or the Copts in Egypt. And it was discovered that the Interior Ministry did instigate that explosion against the churches in Egypt. So it was, the government was behind creating tension among the Egyptians, so to drive the attention from opposing the regime.
That's a fairly typical government attitude in many places, the governmental approach. I'm going to shift because I know the listeners want to hear your thoughts on Libya. This morning, I just read that an emissary from President dictator Gaddafi flew to Cairo for consultation with the military. What is your take on what is happening in Libya?
Well, Libya started as a peaceful uprising, but the Gaddafi regime decided to put it down by military force, and that what create a condition that you have a peaceful movement, but at the same time you have the necessity for defending the people, and all the military person that defected from the regime, they try to play a defender role against the regime forces. So what you have now, you have like military uprising going along with a peaceful uprising, but Gaddafi did have the upper hand by having organized force, have better military equipment, and have also the Air Force, whether helicopter or fixed wings, at his disposal that he was able to employ. But the situation on the ground now is some kind of stalemate with the potential for the uprising to be able to achieve more victories to circle the Gaddafi, who is now in Tripoli. Before I talk about this potential, how they could maneuver to topple him at the end, militarily and otherwise, I think the issue of the envoy is probably one of the ploy of Gaddafi to try to kind of maneuver around what's happening and to buy time and to extend his stay in power, because he is in a position where even he cannot leave the country or have any arrangement to leave the country, because that would amount to a complete defeat to him. So I think he still think that he can hold militarily to attempt to change the situation and probably hold into power and have a better arrangement for any kind of outcome at the end. So I don't take seriously any attempt by the regime to try to have a peaceful solution that resulting in him leaving the country or being deposed. So I think this is completely maneuver now with the kind of isolation that the regime is being threatened with, whether political, diplomatic, legal, and even with the talk about no-fly zone, military embargo, etc. So I think the uprising and the people did not have a well-organized military force at the beginning, and they thought that they could really, with the experience of Tunisia and Egypt, they thought that this is a matter of time that the regime will collapse. They did not, they underestimated the power that Gaddafi had, and at the same time his desire to maintain his rule. So I think now there is more professional army, experienced people. They are organizing the military movement, and the recruiters, the civilian recruiters, they have been also put under the leadership of professional military. And I think from now on, probably we're going to have a better situation on the ground, despite that the attempt by Gaddafi to kind of clear the way west of Tripoli, where he still hold power there, and to attempt to defend Sirte on the eastern, like it's in the middle of the shore of Libya. That Sirte is very symbolic because it's his birthplace, and if it fall in the hands of the revolution in Libya, it will send a strong message for him and for the people around him, and maybe he will have more defection, and probably it will be a matter of a short time for his regime to fall.
Now, at the same time, we have hawks in Washington calling for a no-fly zone. There's resistance on the part of Secretary Gates and some of the Pentagon because what that entails. Also, the neocons at American Enterprise Institute and the Washington Institute are calling for an Afghan or Reagan doctrine kind of war, like the funding of the arming of the Mujahideen against the Soviet Union, the Contras. This could turn into a major war, because Gaddafi is quite likely, if there's a no-fly zone enforced, Gaddafi would shoot down or attempt to shoot down an American plane, and that would start a major war, or possibly could. How do you see the possibility of a no-fly zone, what that would impact that would have on the situation?
I think my personal view, I'm completely against the no-fly zone. It's unfortunate that even people from the interim council that they form inside, and maybe some voices of opposition to regime from outside Libyan, I'm talking about, calling for no-fly zone. They think that this could be a magical instrument to end the rule of the Gaddafi sooner. I think this is a very, very dangerous course, and the Libyan people do have at their disposal all the means to topple the regime, although not, you know, as fast as they wish. But you cannot allow outside influence, outside forces to interfere, because it's not, no country would do that on a charitable consideration. It is well known that the oil and the gas wealth of Libya is at stake, and it seems that Washington and other capitals in Western world, they are maneuvering to see who could get his hand at influencing event in a particular way that could have a future role in controlling the wealth of Libya. So I think it's a dangerous game, and it really displayed that some sort of inexperience by the council that now opposing the regime. The reluctancy by some capitals about or some military, it's well imposing the no-fly zone, not taking into consideration even the opposition of Russia and China for their own reason. But we found some reluctancy by the military at time here, because they know that this is could be a slipping slope toward a conflict that will entail to have ground forces, and that would create a more dangerous situation for the military itself. So I think the best course could have been to have the Libyan among themselves organize themselves, the military equipment that they gained from the regime, plus the defectors from the regime, the military, including even Air Force pilots and others. If they are well organized, they could slowly have a military strategy that could help. What they need the isolation of the regime, no question. They need to have foods and medicine and logistical support coming, and that should have been easily obtained from the Arab world, unfortunately, and especially from Egypt, since the eastern part of Libya is open to the borders, open to Egypt. So there should have been an Arab League movement more than isolating the Gaddafi regime to assist logistically, not even militarily. And even if they need some military help, they should have obtain that, whether by training or some, you know, special equipment or etc., and that the Libyan must do it on their own, or they will, their victory will be tainted. And this is a very dangerous game that they could play, because they could be outmaneuvered by the outside forces who would lend military aid to them and interference, and that would put Libya under another outside forces rule for a longer period of time. So I think probably they can realize, the people now fighting Gaddafi, that this is a dangerous game, and they, despite the pressure that mounted in the UN to have a no-fly zone, I don't think the no-fly zone is the answer to the situation. The situation on the ground need to be changed, and the only way it could change if there is a military strategy that takes into consideration not to allow outside forces to interfere.
My guest is Munzer Sliman. If you have any questions or comments, the number here is 895-2448. Hello, we do have a caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Morning, Jeff. Jeff Wright on the Mendocino Coast. I just saw a CNN report that, unfortunately, the situation in Egypt appears to be breaking down in a basically a civil war between the Muslim Brotherhood, as they described it, and Coptic Christians. It's very disturbing and upsetting that something that started off as what appeared to be a wonderful revolution may be taking the same course as Libya, and I'd like both your takes on that. I'm going to clear the line, Jeff. Thanks for the program.
Thank you.
No, I think this is an exaggeration. It was a very isolated incident, and we cannot probably rule out some of the former government instigators to allow this situation to occur. I'm not saying that there is no tension over the years that occurred between the Copt and between the Muslim in Egypt, but the military interfered, and since the security forces now are not in a prominent position, and there is announcement by the new government to rectify the situation, and some of the probably extremist, let's say, from both sides, they continue to have some kind of demonstrating, allowing the situation to be volatile, but it's limited to one town. And the overwhelming goodwill that occurred during the revolution days, and even prior and after, is still prominent in Egypt. And I don't think you can equate that with what's happening in Libya at all. This is a limited clash that could occur and may occur, but it's not going to be affecting negatively or creating a situation where there would be sort of civil war or sort like that in Egypt.
Thank you. We have the board lit up here. We'll go to the next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello. Yes, I wanted to ask about Israel's involvement. Well, Israel is there, and they're asking for $20 billion more than the $3 billion they already get. They're already well-armed. I think that they're trying to set themselves up, actually, to threaten or destroy the democratic progress in the Arab countries. And I'd like to know the opinion of the guests. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Well, Israel is the big loser for any democratic movement in the Arab world, because they were saved by the dictatorship that aligned with the U.S. Policy. And especially Egypt, for instance, that since the Camp David agreement, Egypt was isolated completely from the Arab-Israeli conflict. And to the extent that the aid that was given to military aid and economic aid for $1.3 billion allow Egypt and Mubarak Egypt to be a servant for United States, and at the same time play a security guard for Israel, and that was indicative in during the war against Gaza in 2008-2009. So I think Israel, no matter how much they accumulate military power, they have already nuclear power. They have probably over to 400, maybe more than different type of nuclear weapons. This will not save them, because if you have something wrong, if you have a colonial, the last colonial regime in the world, the longest one, you cannot really survive, even if you have nuclear weapons or any kinds of weapons, accumulate all kinds of weapons. I think the end is written on the walls now, that Israel will not continue to be as the way that it is ruling the Palestinian right now, as a entity that was created after the Second World War for a purpose, and that entity, the Jews could live in peace like they lived all along with peace, in peace with the Muslims, with the Christian, and the Arab world, but they cannot really have a colonial state continue in the 21st century. And I think no matter how much, they always play any kind of change in the Middle East, they will play it to gain more power and more military from United States and more aid. But I think that's it's not going to save them.
Well, thank you for that. It's interesting. It hasn't been played up, but Egypt no longer sells natural gas to Israel. We have the board still lit up. We have time for maybe a couple more calls. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, would you address the protest in Egypt with the women's rights issue, please?
Yes. The revolution in Egypt, one constant factor was in it is that women participated and played in a very, very important role in the revolution. Hello?
Yes.
During the International Day for Women, there was also some activities by Egyptian women and throughout the Arab world. I think the participation in the political process and also the interference of government in the daily life of or the civil life of society and women, and it's going to be limited. So I think we're going to see, because of the revolution and because of the prominent role that women took part in it, we're going to see a better situation for the women and more participation in the government and in the daily life. More acceptance of its role, because there was some tendency by the regime to play the game of having a limitation of presence and power of women because of religious consideration. This is not, we're going to have a civil society in Egypt, despite having a religion or Islam as a source of the rules and source of guides of laws, but it's not the only one, and that's what going to not allow whether religious extremists or the government who utilize them to suppress the women rights and to keep the women away from being a leader in the daily life of the Egyptians.
Well, thank you very much for the question, and thank you very much for that answer, and thank you very much once again, Munza Sliman, for being our guest today on Takes on the World and giving your opinion and your expert view on what is happening in Egypt and throughout the Maghreb and the Middle East.
You're welcome.
I look forward to speaking with you again. Thanks. Right. Thanks very, very much.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
And that was Munza Sliman. Sorry, the board is still lit up. We don't have time for more calls. Just want to say on next Wednesday on Forthright Radio, host Joy LeClaire will be speaking with journalist Mark Hertzgard, author of On Bended Knee, The Press and the Reagan Presidency, about his latest book, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth, about what coming generations must do to survive catastrophic climate change. And I'll be back here with you in 2 weeks with another Takes on the World. And on March 31st, the fifth Wednesday, we will have open lines. Podcasts of this and prior programs can be found on the website radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, plus all.net. And look for contributor using my first name. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Earth and Sky and then Beyond Bach with Jim Denton.